When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
This is the Music Buzz Podcast. The Music Buzz Podcast features candid discussions with and about those behind the scenes in the music business, including industry veterans representing the segments of musician, design, and live. All three Music Buzz Podcast hosts have spent their careers working with the biggest names in entertainment and have been and are still a fly on the wall. Dane Clark as the drummer for John Mellencamp's band for over 20 years and various solo projects. Hugh Syme, a world-renowned graphic artist for the biggest names in music and the corporate world. Andy Wilson, an award-winning marketing and public relations executive with over 20 years of combined multi-level entertainment industry experience in the music and sports business. Now let's buzz.
Welcome one and all to the Music Buzz Podcast. I'm Andy Wilson, along with host Dane Clark. Hey, Dane.
Andy, how are you doing, sir?
Good. And also the legendary Hugh Syme as well. Hello, Hugh.
Dane's legendary too, but hello, Andrew.
He is. I know. I just like to say legendary for one of us.
Why not? Okay, thank you.
So our guest today is basically he's an Indiana guy. So this is kind of a cool opportunity for all of us because we're always sitting in Indiana, usually talking to people that aren't in Indiana, aren't from Indiana. And though Kyle's not technically sitting in Indiana as we talk to him, he's from Indiana. So this is an Indiana Hoosiers conversation today with Kyle Cook. Great guitar player. He spent the bulk of his musical life as the lead guitarist for Matchbox 20, a multi-Grammy nominated band that sold nearly 16 million albums, 16 million, and toured the globe and is one of the most popular American rock bands from the past 20 plus years. Kyle has released a lot of his own solo stuff and also headed up a lot of his own bands, including The New Left and Rivers and Rust. Great release a couple years ago called Wolves. He's also recorded with Mick Jagger and John Waite, amongst others. He's also a studied musician with an all-American Midwestern background. He's a guy with a penchant for classic rock, which we'll dig deep into that because I can already tell the passion for classic rock before we jumped into the podcast here. But of course, he's from Frankfort, Indiana, which before we jump too far ahead of ourselves and talk music, let's open up and talk a little bit about Frankfort and let's talk about their mascot, if you don't mind. I think that's a perfect place to start.
Yeah, let's start with that. I'm a hot dog.
That's all we need.
Yeah. And
well, if I could be frank with you. No, I'm
there you go.
Yeah. Ding, 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 ding. I don't even know what the I have no idea what the history behind that mascot is, to be quite honest. I feel like I should understand the culture of how a random little town in central Indiana adopted, you know, the hot dog as a mascot. But yeah. Yeah, there could be cooler.
It's one of the best, but hey. There's that one, and there's also, and I forget what town it's in, there's also one in Indiana called the Jeeps, which I always thought was
the
badass.
Jeeps?
Nice. Yeah, it's like, nice. How cool is that, right? Especially in high school.
Yeah, but anyway. You know, I actually have a dachshund. My oldest daughter has her now. She's a senior dachshund now, but yeah, so.
Nice.
I identify with the love of dachshunds.
Awesome. Wiener dogs are cool.
Yeah.
They're awesome.
So the Music Buzz Podcast, Kyle, just to give you a little background, the three of us like to talk, but we also represent kind of three different areas in the entertainment business. Hugh on the graphic design and that side, Dane on the musician side, me on the kind of the concert promoter and live side. So we're going to dig into those three areas. Okay.
Yeah.
Dane's going to kick us off dig into some of that stuff.
On no, that's cool, man. That's Brett. Let's do it.
Yeah. Kyle, man. Great to talk to you. Glad you're here with us today. And I read up on you a little bit, and we've already talked a few times about some other stuff too, but when was it that you realized that when you first realized music was your calling? I read that you started as a violinist.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that was important in the development of, you know, understanding music, playing violin, and, you know, obviously led me to, then playing guitar, I think, cause that was the next move. But I think if you take steps back, historically, I think it kind of happened in church. You know, I used to, my mom sings, plays piano, not professionally. My family's kind of musical, just not professionally. Like everyone really appreciates it. Like my dad sings and can sing harmony, and my grandmother did. So, you know, there's a little Presbyterian church, First Presbyterian in Frankfort, Indiana, that, you know, we would go, or I would go as a kid, and sit in between my grandmother and my mother. And they were singing harmony. And I remember that's probably my earliest memories of starting to pick out, different notes and how they, you know, their relationship to each other. It's like, oh, she's singing this and she's singing that. And there's kind of like a root note on the organ. They actually had this beautiful, still have this beautiful pipe organ in there, which I always love to go back and in the holidays and sort of get that nostalgic feeling again, like hearing that tone. But I think that's kind of where it started. And then the interest in violin sort of followed, because I needed some way to, take what was kind of in my mind and put it, you know, I had no thoughts of playing guitar at that time, oddly enough. I think it was just kind of like, you know, my elementary school was starting orchestra. They just sort of like incorporated the orchestra into my elementary school, which really doesn't seem to happen that much anymore. It seems like budgets are getting slashed and, you know, instruments, are tough to come by, and you go to schools, they don't have real pianos anymore, it seems. So I feel like kind of blessed to have that. I'll sort of leave it there. As my hands started to get bigger physically, I started to realize that, I just really wasn't a great violinist anyway. I couldn't figure out the vibrato. That didn't make sense to me, because you have to kind of do a circular pattern as opposed to vibrating the string up and down. And so it was probably like late middle school, early high school, where I kind of realized that, I got introduced to the guitar, and that was a much better fit for me as a player.
Great. So when you grew up in Frankfort, like to go back to the early days again.
Yeah.
Tell us about your first band that you played in.
First band that I
played in. Garage bands?
I think we were calling ourselves Downpour or something. It was a couple guys from school, and we had a singer named Lester Gleason that was really great. He was great. And I think all we wanted to sound like was Pearl Jam, basically. Mm-hmm. And that's all he wanted to sound like.
I was going
to
say, what kind of music was Downpour? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. This was in the era of like Jeremy was, you know, that's what.
Early 90s.
Yeah. Even Flow and all that, like kind of owned the radio. So I think all we really wanted to do was just imitate Pearl Jam. And that's, you know, we sounded like a bad Pearl Jam cover band.
Did you record some stuff?
Yeah, we did in Indianapolis. I remember like having that feeling of like holding a cassette, you know, and somebody's dad owned a printing press or something. We, you know, like, and we had the insert in the cassette. And like, I remember that feeling of like,
we got a record
genuine,
here.
Genuine like accomplishment. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like something's going to happen now. It's here.
It's right tangible. Here. Right.
Yeah, I can hand this to somebody, you know?
That's coming from, you know, obviously the opportunity to go and do something like that is such a big deal at that age. Fast forward for us, if you will, for a second. And I know you recorded on that Mick Jagger solo album that he did.
Which was
Visions of Paradise. Great song.
Yeah, which was amazing. I'd love to talk about that too. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about, you know, here's the Kyle Cook that, you know, goes and makes a cassette tape, you know, in Indiana to the guy that's in the studio with Mick Jagger. Let's talk about that for a second.
And it wasn't that too long of a time span between that, really.
No kidding. Yeah.
Pretty amazingly.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. I mean, like I said, not even a decade, because, you know, we had that first album had, just to give some context, you know, before I was 23, which would have been a decade of actually playing my instrument, you know, before the age of 23, we had almost approaching a diamond selling debut album. So it was just, it was absolute insanity. And I don't even think that, you know, now we can appreciate it, because I try to go, man, if that had happened in an era like today where everything you do practically is documented online.
Right.
I feel like we had opened up for the Stones, and I'm trying to remember if it was before I did that session or after. And I think it might've been before. We did a thing called Rock Fest in Dallas. It was at the Dallas Motor Speedway. It was this huge, crazy event, like 3-day event. They were on that. I think we played with them twice. Once, I want to say, on that, and then another, and then they asked us back to open up for them on, I'm trying to remember which tour it was. They had these gigantic gargoyles, and it started with Satisfaction, like this bullet
came to the front.
Bridges of Babylon.
Yeah. So we got to open up for them one time on the Bridges to Babylon tour. And so I'd already had that experience, you know, like, I think I was pretty cocky at the time, quite honestly. I think we all were, because, you know, just the album was just, it just seemed like every single Atlantic put out on that record was a hit.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there were 5 top 10 singles on that record, and it seemed like they could have just kept going. I mean, we were, none of us were prepared for any of that, but, we had an opportunity to open up for them. And I remember they brought us, you know, we all rolled up to the Speedway, and there were, like, you know, corridors of, like, tour buses, right? You know, we're, like, on the golf cars, and we're, like, they're pulling us in. And it's just, like, walls of tour bus on each side. We go in, they got, like, signs everywhere. You know, Keith's bar that way, rehearsal room this way, mix room that way. They were, like, literally, like, it was a village that they had set up for the Stones. Yeah.
Awesome.
And it was like meeting the president, man. And it's important leading up to the studio thing. It's like meeting the president. It already was in our minds, but it was just, you know, amazing. The security guys, and they'd pull us to a point, and they'd be like, hold on here. And we'd stand there for a second, and they'd bring us to another checkpoint. And then, you know, people in, like, earpieces and tuxedo, or, you know, in, like, suits and shit. And we finally get there, line us up, and then they just bring the Stones in and line us all up. And they were wonderful, man. I mean, they really, but Mick particularly is just a real, you can tell that he is, you know, he's made a real decision to be the face of the band, you know, and to be the sort of ambassador of the Stones, you know? Mm-hmm. So that was kind of my first experience. And then we did a European tour where we were opening up for Bon Jovi. And we were there for, it was a UK run, and we were there for maybe like 2 weeks, and we opened up for them, but we did some headlining shows. We were just kind of starting to develop a following in the UK, and that was the reason that we were there opening up for Bon Jovi. And so we were doing some legendary theater in London. I'm not sure if it was the Hammersmith, maybe. I think it might've been the Hammersmith Ballroom.
Yeah.
And we did, and we closed with Hinder, or in our encore, we did a Hendrix song. I remember if it was Little Wing or Purple Haze or something like that. No, it was All on the Watchtower. And I just kind of went off for several minutes at the end of it. And then Mick came back with, like, this whole entourage and was really complimentary. And then the next day, I get a call from management saying that, you know, Mick would like me to come in and play on the song that he and Rob had co-written, because they had, you know, I think Rob was really riding high on being one of the most important songwriters on the charts at that point, you know?
Oh, yeah, so, definitely.
you know, the Santana thing, you know, obviously grew from that. And then, you know, people like Willie Nelson, who is, I mean, when you got Willie Nelson, like, reaching out to you to write a song, I mean, you know, like, something's really going right with your craft. So, yeah, so they had written a song, and it was like, you know, Mick's going to send you a car. My wife and I, my ex-wife now, at the time, were getting dressed to go out and have like a really nice dinner. It was like a day off, and I just get this call, like, you know, Mick's like, you come in and play in the studio, he'll pay you triple scale, he's gonna send a car, but you know, it's gonna be like in about 2 or 3 hours. And so I remember looking at my wife in this, you know, fancy hotel in London, like, and she's just like, yeah, we're not going to dinner. And I didn't expect him to be there. I know the story's getting long.
It's great.
So I didn't expect him to be there, right? I'm like, it's Mick. It's larger than life. Hmm. He answers the door of the studio and like with tea, you know, greets me. And of course, you know, as like a consolation prize to my wife, I'm like, you know, you got to come to the studio and meet Mick, right? I mean, that seems fair.
Yeah, of course,
I sort of cleared that because we just canceled all our plans for the day. And so he greets her and I, and he's like really charming. And I think I remember thinking at the time, Mick might actually steal my wife. That could happen. That could probably happen.
Maybe it's not about the song after all.
Yeah. I was like, I start second guessing myself on that. So he's like really sweet and charming, and whatever. And we go in, and the producer on the record, they had some amps set up, and Pete Townsend's amp was still set up from the night before. And so I played through Pete Townsend's amp.
Wow.
Which just made it that much more amazing.
Yeah, because he had a bunch of, like, it was like an all-star kind of record. We had a whole bunch of people playing on it.
Yeah.
But it's a good record, though, still.
Yeah, it was a solid record. I don't think they ever singled the one that I played on that Rob co-wrote, but I think the single on that record was the Lenny Kravitz, one of the Lenny Kravitz collabs or something.
So let's shift gears and go in to talk about the graphic side and the visual aspect of music in general and yours specifically. So Hugh was going to, you know, ask some questions in that regard as far as album artwork and stuff.
Absolutely.
And kind of dig into that.
Well, I have to confess by starting, you know, I am very familiar with your music. Haven't been a follower, so that doesn't expose me too much to your catalog. So I cribbed today and found, I noticed a sort of a trend towards minimalism and simplicity, which I liked. You know, the band on the cover, you know, that kind of clarity is refreshing. But I was, without regard to even knowing who you were at the time, I did love the painting for Mad Season. I thought that was a great.
Right, I was just about to say, Yeah,
it's
the peacock on wheels.
Well, it was also that peculiar character. Yeah, but the character. The style of that was refreshing. It was new. And I also know when I like something, because when I look at a cover and I feel a remote pang of jealousy, it's a reality that it's a good cover. But I do, you know, and I like the fact that your videos are also they're very driven by kind of the honesty of performance, even though there's always kind of some sort of dark, melancholic kind of tone to even the lighting and the way you guys are filmed. And of course, you delve
into Back to Good. Back to Good is a good reference for that.
Unwell, too, has got a nice, starts off with a kind of a, you know, an easily accessible personnel. But then it gets nicely distorted, and it, you know, stays whimsical, of course, you know.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think, which may be reflected in the music too, a little bit with the use of the banjo, even though it's kind of a dark song, Unwell.
It's a very cool lick, man.
Thank you, man. And
that's double stop thing that you're playing on. That was a real banjo, wasn't it?
No.
That wasn't.
It's a six, like a six string, like
banjo guitar or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah.
How drawn to the process? I mean, this is, you know, I ask these questions because I'm always interested in knowing. Some band members are they're musicians and they lean on anybody from the record company's art department. I mean, ZZ Top, for example, they would lean on Kim Champagne at Warner's to do the covers, you know, and some bands are very involved. Some members, more than others. Neil and I and Rush would be very much the allies for that process. The other guys were busy making music. How about you? Were you hands-on?
I'd love to speak to that. In the later years, so Paul Doucette, who was the original drummer and now is the rhythm guitar player. So we've lost one member since the first three records. And he was always, and I still think is, kind of the driving creative force behind a lot of those things. Now, not to the extent of like coming up with the designs and actually directing the videos or anything, but really being someone who stayed up late. I mean, even you know, he was always the last one to leave. Like when we were doing like production rehearsals in arenas, like he was always the guy that was, you know, we were worried was going to be so tired for the opening night of a tour because he was literally with the lighting designers, you know, till 4 or 5 in the morning, you know, the night before, like trying to make sure that every little move for every song was. So yeah, Paul really, I got to give a lot of credit to him. Matter of fact, he was the guy that found that image of the peacock that you mentioned.
Yeah.
Suggested that. He may have also been behind the choice or kind of helped push us towards that choice of the kind of heavy set guy with the cap on the first.
Yeah. Fantastic. What's that? Yourself or someone.
Yeah. Yourself or someone like you. Yeah. That image has really just, you know, become synonymous with our band.
It's amazing what simple, and that reminds me of a Joel Peter Witkin cover, which is, you know, just quirky and bravely kind of not attractive, you know?
Right. Well, you know, there's a method to the madness. I mean, I think behind at least that first album. So we, you know, the title Yourself or Someone Like You. And I think if you look at the trajectory of the band, we have always been, I don't think anybody would disagree with the exception of, you know, Rob kind of having that sort of next level fame with the Santana thing, with the Smooth thing. We have always kind of been a little bit of a faceless band in the sense that you know our music a lot more than you do our faces.
You bring up an interesting point, and I think it's funny. I just got back from Europe, my wife and I did, and I was, you know, on this long flight from Paris to Detroit, and I was looking for something to watch, and there was something in the music documentaries thing. I'm like, oh, what is this? And it was weird that it was on the Delta flight, but it was a backgrounder that included Boston, REO, and Styx. And it was kind of talking about how at the time music shifted from kind of these rock stars, these people that you knew, into really like logos and songs. So it talked about More Than a Feeling. It was talking about Babe. It was talking about, you know, Roll with the Changes. But I was like, and I know who's in these bands because I love those bands, love your band. But, you know, it really, to me, Matchbox 20 is like that next generation of those bands, you know, that's kind of like an REO, a Styx, a Boston, and that's bad.
Yeah, I agree.
You know,
and I agree. Yeah.
Like great company, but it was interesting that there was actually, you know, something on the flight basically talking about what you're saying.
Or like Journey, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Like,
yeah. Journey.
Like, right.
I've, which, you know, I guess depending on who you ask is a good or bad thing. I've definitely heard people draw comparisons to our catalog to sort of like, you know, as like a modern Journey.
Are you, talking like, music? Because going back to
that,
I would say graphically, you guys were much more brave in your selfie facing kind of, like I said, yourself and someone else in that painting for Mad Season. Those are beautifully quirky and they didn't subscribe to that kind of Styx, Journey kind of corporate logo based work that you would see a lot of with the Van Halens and so on, bands that needed to have logos, you know.
Oh, I got you. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, if you've ever seen us live or, you know, when you get to know the band, I mean, there was this there was just this kind of regular guy vibe with our band.
That's what I think. Yeah.
You know, was trying to be, you know, and even the sound of, you know, like, we're not a proggy band, like, you know, like a Rush, which is like very intellectual, you know, really pushing the boundaries of what music can be.
Right.
And, you know, in songs, I mean, you know, a lot of our songs are very economical, you know, in the way they're constructed, with the emphasis on hooks and memorable, you know, little memorable melodic pieces that you can either take away, like you mentioned, like whether it's the banjo look, which right. to reference that again, that was something that we spent working with Matt Serletic, who's a brilliant producer in his own right and a brilliant, you know, just musician in his own right. We would work very, very hard at in thinking about like, hey, Rob's brought this song to the table that we think is great, but now we have to, you know, now the craft is the arrangement,
right.
You know, and that's, you know, or the master, you know, the thing that, you know, I always likened it to like, you know, like, you know, you have to make a movie, right? But first you have a script, you have a good script, but the script,
it needs set dressing.
People don't read the script. People watch the movie, and then that's what they identify with, and that's what they take with them for the rest of their life. So we always look at them. The making of the masters in that moment, you know, especially when we started getting really great budgets from Atlantic. I mean, we would spend some time on that Mad Season record. I mean, I think we took 7 months to 7-8 months making that record, spent millions of dollars, which doesn't happen anymore. We'd spend weeks on like the intro to a song, you know? I mean, you know, before we even get to the verse, it was just like, it has to be the right sound. It has to be the right thing. Like you were saying,
right.
When that comes on the first like 20 seconds, it pulls you in and you know exactly what the song is, just like an opening scene of a movie or something. Like, oh my God, I love this scene. And then you sit down on the couch and you watch the whole thing. So a lot of effort went into that.
And it sure paid off for you guys. Millions of records sold later.
Yeah, there's
a reason for that. Yeah,
I'd like to believe that time that was invested, you know, paid off. But you know, to reference the graphic side of things, when we chose that image, there definitely was an intention behind that, because Yourself or Someone Like You is intended to be almost. There was a little bit of that because we were coming to that era of the alternative, the almost like anti-rock star. Era
like War with the boy on the cover for U2, that struck me as very iconic. He was cuter than the man on your cover, but that's what I admire mostly about the Yourself covers, because it is just purely quirky, and it's not unsettling, but it's not attractive, and it dares to be its own entity, and yet the music spoke for itself. You make a good point about the economy of your songs and the structuring of your songs. Therein lies the difference between a band like yours and Rush, because Rush was about arrangement, I think, sometimes more than the song.
Right. You know? I agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that there was a unique situation because you had Neil Peart actually writing all the lyrics, which is, you know, sort of
pretty heady. Way
out of bounds of how, you know, most bands kind of work. But I think, you know, I think that image struck a chord because, you know, I think society, you know, like the social, like the cultural climate at the time was a little sort of like anti rock star, like, you know, the totally. Everyday person, glamorizing the idea that the everyday person can be as important as, you know, especially coming out of the 80s, right? Which was all about like everything was oversexed and glamorized, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And kind of surfaced maybe a little bit, you know, well, like.
I'm glad I was there, but yeah.
What you remember of it, right?
No, speaking to your earlier comment about tenacity and craft and so on, I was living in LA at a time when it could have done irreparable damage to me to be there, but I had the good fortune of being a workaholic and having a good work ethic. So I really missed out on, I did go to the Roxy a couple of times and I did witness salad bowls of cocaine and things like that, but it was you know, it wasn't something that I subscribed.
Salad bowls of cocaine. That sounds like a perfect,
that's a lot,
perfect song title. Why don't you guys get together after this and write
surely
a song
nobody
called
put any dressing
Salad
on it,
Bowls of Cocaine. Sorry.
Hold the dressing.
I'll be quiet now.
I kid you not. I kid you not. Behind the velvet ropes sat a very dynamic rock star whose name will go unmentioned, but he was flanked by some pretty outrageously beautiful women, and right in front of him was his bowl. So you knew that the police commissioner and that club was pretty much in concert with each other.
Oh yeah,
he was dipping in the bowl too, I reckon.
Probably, yeah. So I have to ask the question that I have, whether it's a band or a client and so on. I'm always interested in knowing musicians' favorite covers, whether they are their own. Or just, you know, in history, what covers have spoken to you as being brilliant? You know, like for me, the White Album was a brilliantly cheeky, and only the Beatles could get away with such a faceless cover because we are, after all, the Beatles. But I'd love to hear what you consider to be your favorite covers from history.
I always loved Disraeli Gears.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ah.
Yeah.
And is it Rubber Soul or is it Meet the Beatles? What was the four floating faces?
The black and white with the lit light from the side was...
Yeah, from the side,
that,
yeah.
That was Meet the Beatles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Meet the Beatles. That always was always a striking cover to me. Always.
Yeah. And much emulated thereafter. The whole...
Yeah, half, totally.
The half-lit black face and white, that...
Exactly. Yeah. The simplicity of using, you know, shadows and you know, in beautiful ways.
Yeah.
But at the same time, highlighting the members of the band.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I don't remember which Boston album it was, but the sort of like
the guitar spacecraft.
Yeah, the spacecraft thing. Yeah.
Pretty iconic and famous, yeah.
I mean, you almost can't talk about record covers and not talk about Sgt. Pepper's.
No.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot going on, but I remember staring at that album as a kid because my stepfather had it on vinyl. And, you know, I remember just, you know, what would seem like hours staring at it and still finding new visuals, you know. So, you know, and then just all the mystique that was wrapped around, you know, like somebody's holding something and there's another head back there and it's there because of this. And, you know, just all the conclusions that were drawn from it was just kind of fascinating.
Speaking of salad bowls. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
No. Yeah. It is definitely a phenomenal cover. And yet, you know, what's beautiful about that cover is it's technically so primitive and yet it still was conceptually. And I think concept sometimes, you know, it overrides the execution.
If I can ask you a question, I don't want to derail this, but how do you, like, you know, talking about videos and, you know, just the importance of, you know, we've almost kind of, you know, we're living in this time, right? Where like, and it's relevant to the Matchbox conversation because, you know, we were an MTV, you know, we were one, I think one of the things that really contributed to our success at the time too was that, you know, it was kind of the height of MTV and VH1 and, you know,
absolutely. Yeah.
You had that extra vehicle, you know, we kind of had the benefit of being successful in a time where, you know, television and the visual was really important. And then the internet was also starting to become a factor.
Yeah.
So we kind of, you know, midway through our career started to benefit from the, you know, the digital side of things. But now, you know, we look at something like MTV and it's all reality television. They've changed their format.
Yeah.
You know, CMT totally was hanging on for a minute and they still play videos, but you know, even they are going, you know, to licensing old movies and you know what I mean?
Right.
I have two daughters. I know you guys all have kids too. It's like, you know, television is not how they digest things. So how do you feel about the importance of video, the role of videos?
First of all, I was peripherally involved. I did art direction on Rush videos and so on, but I was never a video director. I often wanted to be, I often thought I could be very, I saw how much work there was involved in doing it. I also saw some of the varying budgets involved and how much was expected, you know,
I spend so much money on videos. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. I think one of the reasons you don't see videos as much now is people are too hip to being, because the Brits were very, very clear on calling videos commercials. They would call them commercials instead of videos. And I think that's a telling term, because to try and sell any young person today music, they need to find it on their own. So if you package something up and make it too slick, that doesn't mean that if you do a YouTube piece and there's a performance, there's a section of performance in the YouTube piece, it wouldn't speak to someone, but it needs to come off as, you know, it's like watching Harry Styles singing on the Howard Stern show. If you've never seen,
I saw that performance.
Yeah, it's a great performance. And what's nice, what's charming about it, but telling, is you see how talented he and his band is, but it's right off the floor. And that stuff, I think, speaks more to people now than a David Mallet video for, you know. And there was a couple of Russell Mulcahy and David Mallet. They did all of the Aerosmith, Whitesnake. They did.
Right. Yeah, which, there was a run there with Aerosmith where their videos were just.
Oh, yeah.
Epic mini movies, man. Yep. I mean, you know.
And that was during the Get a Grip era, which Hugh did the cover for the Get a Grip album.
Oh, man, that's a great cover, too. That's with the car, right?
And cow in Indiana? Is that an Indiana cow?
That's a Henry County cow. Let's be
okay, specific. Sorry.
Yeah.
God, you did so much great stuff, Hugh. Man, I'm going straight to You're next up on Google when we finish this up. I'm gonna look at all your stuff.
Oh, thanks. No, I hope you enjoy it. And yeah, it'd be an honor to work with you on something. It'd be great.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, as it relates to the importance of that, I still, I was saying, like, you know, now it's sort of like, it's almost like we're back to the importance is on the single, you know, almost like it was in the 50s or something, where, you know, totally. the art form around, which is kind of sad to me because I love making albums, but it just seems like, you know, the playlisting and people falling in love with the song is where it has to begin.
Dane and Andy and I have talked about this. Abbey Road or The Wall, those are intended to be listened to in their entirety. But today, someone would go in and pick Here Comes the Sun, and a couple of other songs. You come together, but the rest of the album would be left fallow because it didn't get the long bar. It didn't get the long bar of public approval.
People can't hold their attention span. It's so much shorter now than it was.
Yeah.
Right. Maybe we were just, you know, when we were young in the 60s and 70s, you know, and you're looking at that album cover and,
right,
maybe rolling something on the thing that's, if it was a double album cover or whatever.
We're getting out your salad bowl of cocaine. Well,
but you know, it's very telling. I think that attention spans just don't allow for that.
Attention spans and the fact that millennials often don't even know what a physical CD is. They've been brought up through Napster, the now defunct LimeWire, I think it was called, where you could kind of peer-to-peer steal and borrow and loan music to people. Even iTunes, I've coined this phrase innumerable times, but we're all feeding off the carcass of what used to be that industry we're talking about, because even as a designer, if it wasn't for my legacy clients like Rush and Dream Theater, who still love the feel of paper and the smell of ink, you know, we would all be kind of designing for YouTube and designing for that 2-inch square in the bottom corner of iTunes. You know, it's a very different realm we work in now.
But that doesn't mean that the image isn't important, I guess, is kind of the point I was getting to.
Absolutely.
Like, I find myself, you know, really thinking about, so if it's an important show, like I got a dream coming up and I'm going to try to help raise some money for a cool venue. Some friends of mine own a Masonic temple actually up in outside of Grand Rapids. They got this cool little venue. And when I tour solo, I play it all the time. So I'm going to go up and do that. But, you know, thinking about like the image that I put behind the post. Now I find myself thinking a lot more about that, you know,
and I have this guy
named Keith Brogdon that is great that, he did a couple cool Sturgill Simpson records. Mm. Actually, there's a cover. Look at a couple of the Sturgill Simpson covers. I cannot remember the name of it. He's kind of like this anti-country.
He's great.
Country guy.
He's a cool artist.
Yeah, man. He's a super cool artist, but like, you know, like Music Row just doesn't give him any love because, you know, it's like too cool for like country radio or whatever.
It's like real country. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, like he does a cover like Smells Like Teen Spirit with like a horn section. You know what I mean? Like it's kind of
some R&B stuff too. Yeah. Huh? He's very eclectic. Some of it's kind of R&B.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I've been using his graphic guy for a long time, but like I'll spend a couple $100 on a post if I think it's important enough. You know what I mean? Like I'll get with him. I'll be like, make sure he's got a couple photographs that I think were great. I'll tell him what I think, we're going for, whether there's a theme, and just kind of let him run wild. But like, I never thought that much about it before, you know, like when all these apps came out and you could do like stuff yourself, just find cool fonts, you know. I think a lot of us were doing that. Mm-hmm. And now I feel like maybe there's a resurgence in the appreciation of somebody like yourself, Hugh, who really, you know, is artistic and understands the value of choosing different fonts or creating things that have their own, you know, individual feel as opposed to just stuff that people can, because now everybody can just grab stuff off the internet and like use generic things. And
there's also the opportunity. I mean, I appreciate you making that acknowledgement, and I'd like to think there's some merit to what you're saying, but even my daughters, you know, one of my daughters has got her own business and I offered to do her business card and I did a really good job of it, I thought, but she turned around and using her own online facility.
So she turned you down?
She did. I was kicked to the curb. I was dismissed.
Did you show her like all the Rush albums and show her like, you know, all these like, okay. No,
right. Leave your name with the lady at the front. We'll get in touch, you know. There you
go. It's important to be humble. That's why we had kids, man. Right?
That's kids for you.
That's right.
I mean, the reality is we also have to be humble enough to understand. It's the same thing with arrangements. It's the same thing with writing songs. Like, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes you don't need the jazz chord. You know what I mean? Like, sometimes just the G to C is all you need.
Yeah.
The cowboy chords work. They've always worked, you know, like, and sometimes you gotta, just because you know that there's, you know, this whole palette of colors that you can use doesn't mean you should need to use as well.
You know, I've done some pretty elaborate and indulgent and complex covers for Rush. And I've also done a cover, I refer to them because they're probably one of the most freeing recording artists that allowed me the latitude to, and they coined a beautiful phrase early in their career called deviate from the norm. It kind of became their credo. They would try not to repeat themselves. Sometimes they would get stuck into stylistic redundancies, but we all do, I think. But, you know, one cover would be complex, and then Counterparts was a nut and a bolt. And it took a little selling. I was convinced that minimalism would work, but daring to be minimal and to be bravely sort of stripped down like that, I think has its place. So I agree. Yeah. And I also think that when people do their own thing, there's merit to that. And then when you mentioned, you know, maybe possibly talking to me, the fun that I have is harvesting imagery from the music and harvesting some kind of theme that plays, because we're not dealing with an album with a front and back cover. We're dealing with CD booklets, which are commonly 16 to 40 pages long. So what do you fill the booklet with except ways to editorialize the music or to play?
And what happens out of that, going back to part of the earlier conversation, you know, with the image from the first Matchbox record that sticks in my mind. When I hear Matchbox 20 said, that image of that guy in the hat comes to my mind. Well, Hugh's no different in regards to the Rush with the Starman. Really, correct me if I'm wrong, Hugh, but that wasn't intentionally created to be a logo, correct? Wasn't that just kind of became its own thing?
That was just thematically tied to the every man, the freedom of expression versus the red star of the evil Federation. I literally took man against Federation and made that into a logo. It was very literal. But little did I know it was going to be adopted, you know.
Right. That's what I mean. Yeah. All of a sudden it takes a life of its own kind of thing.
How awesome that it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. You know, it's interesting. And I know we spent a lot of time on that cover, but it what's interesting about that shoot, the fact that they chose that close-up of just him against the window, sort of looking sad, like he's trapped, you know, he's kind of like trapped, or he's outside trying to come in. It's kind of like the vibe you get from that. Right. Which does speak to the social kind of norms that we live in, you know? Right.
Did you cast him or did you find him?
Yeah, so we did. Yeah. So there were, he was a model that was hired by some agency, you know, what we were looking for, and there was a whole shoot. This is what's interesting about it. There was a whole shoot.
Wow.
If you look in the inside of the cover, you see a couple of the images that sort of will explain what I'm saying. But the whole idea was, so one of the singles is called Real World, which you mentioned, right? That was one of the ones I didn't co-write as well. Real World, you know, Rob talks about, I wonder what it's like to be a superhero in that song. So one of the themes was kind of taken from that song. This idea that just the average person can be a superhero, right? Just which is yourself or someone like you, right? So it fit the whole theme. So we wanted him, this kind of overweight guy in a cape, in a Superman. He was in a Superman outfit, cape, and they just put this aviator hat on him. So he was, here's this like, you know, pudgy guy standing there with the superhero thing, looking all sad. And they had this beautiful model, like this just gorgeous Italian girl, you know, slender and standing there. And he's kind of like looking at her, you know, longingly. And like, there's all these images like that. And then it just, you know, that was kind of what the cover was going to be, right? It's like, she was kind of like this unattainable beauty that this, you know, this overweight superhero guy was never going to be able to sort of like, you know, I don't know if they were trying to convey that he was going to save her or, you know, or have a relationship with her, whatever the deal was, but there's all these shots. But the one they end up using is just him. And all you see is the aviator cap. So you don't get any of that imagery.
No.
So we really sort of did away with all of these themes and it, you know, and I think when everybody saw that image, they felt exactly like what you just surmised right there, which is just, that's it. That says it. We don't have to second guess it anymore.
Had you put the extra element in there, while it may have spoken to the unattainable concept that you just mentioned, it would have lost its simplicity, and it may have certain things, whether it's music or imagery, there's a point at which that phrase comes into play, trying too hard, you know, I'm guilty of that sometimes. I love improbable reality, and I like being, you know, and I like to play with, you know, things that feel real but shouldn't be. And that's fun, but there's also a place for just that one icon on the cover, which is that man.
And I think it speaks, you know, as far as Matchbox, to, you know, the way we run, the way we've worked creatively, musically too, I think it speaks to that, because we have been pretty good at kind of policing ourselves. Like, we're a band that's there's can be a lot of tension when we're in the studio. There can be, like, everyone gets involved. It feels like almost every little part, people have opinions about things. Like, I remember having to recut an acoustic part for a song where I was basically playing acoustic the entire time. I was like the whole downbeat of the song, and there wasn't much other instrumentation. And I ended up having to re-record it 2 or 3 times because, you know, Rob just felt like the feel wasn't the right feel for him to sing to, or whatever. Like, it was too swung, or it wasn't swung enough,
right,
or those kind of things. And it's interesting how those kind of tensions, the way that we kind of fight to make sure that, you know, all these voices are kind of fighting to be heard, so that it's, you know, ultimately that's what makes it a band, which is maybe something that Dane, you know, working for John, it's a whole, and when I work with John Waite, totally different thing, right? Like, John Waite makes the last,
he's going to make that decision.
He makes the damn call, you know what I'm saying? And I'm sure that's how it is with, with Mellencamp.
Yeah, John. Well, definitely. I mean, it's his song, so he's going to make that call. And he kind of likes to direct us. But when we get something going that is good, when the band gets into a thing, he lets us go.
Right.
He knows.
Good, yeah.
And he may say something like when we're done, like, well, it wasn't really what I had in mind, but I think we can make a record with that or something like that, you know. When what he really meant was, man, that was great. And then later on, he'll actually say that was great. So.
Yeah, because that's the dialogue, right? Like there's
a
conversation going, and maybe it wasn't where you thought the conversation was going to go, but that doesn't mean it's not great. And, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
And he knows that everybody, and you guys were doing the same thing. A band does that, and that's the neat thing about having a band all playing at the same time.
It certainly is, yeah.
Or at least the rhythm section, you know, where you get that vibe and you're chomping at the bit to make this thing happen.
Yeah.
That's a feeling that is getting lost these days when people make records.
It's all about trust, right? I mean, at the end of the day, the greatest bands, the greatest musicians, I mean, there's a trust element, whether that's, you know, the band in studio, whether it's the live experience, whether that's the guy doing the record cover, whether that's, you know, whoever it is.
To Kyle's point, though, a band has a sort of a different dynamic than, say, working with John or John Waite or John.
Oh, sure.
If you're a band like the Beatles and so on, I have 32 bootleg tapes of the boys at Epic Studios and Olympic Studios, and they definitely interacted and they were very respectful, but there was lots of arguments and lots back and forth, and occasionally some pettiness, you know, just what about me kind of.
Sure.
Right. And a band needs, and to your point, a band needs to know how to get out of their own way and be that organism, which obviously the successful bands are, like yours.
So tell us about some of the moments over your career where you've been on stage and like maybe a special guest came out, or you just found yourself, you know, kind of in a geek out moment a little bit, you know, whether it was a specific venue or whatever it might be.
Well, okay. So, and I think it was in that 2 week period of time, that I was talking about, in when we were in England, when I did the Jagger session, we did, Santana, you know, Smooth was kind of eating the planet at that time too.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Rob was, you know, at the top of the songwriting food chain, and, you know, he just was just like, hey, you know, like Santana's playing at whatever arena was there in England and in London. And so we went and I got up on stage and kind of, you know, like, because Santana's the kind of, like, he's that guy. He's that jammy guy, you know, just sure. Like, oh, man, you're here. You got your guitar, right? You know, like, and if you don't, we'll give you a guitar. So, you know, he pulls me up to play, and Jimmy Page was backstage, and I think he was trying to pull Jimmy. I think Jimmy ended up bowing out, but he was really trying to get Jimmy up. But I just, that was a revelatory moment, because I think, I'm sure if you ask my ex-wife, she would say I was a blubbering idiot. I remember it like I was really cool. Maybe I'd had too many cocktails, quite possibly. Right. Mm-hmm. I don't want to, you know, in my mind, I was like very respectful. I'm sure if you ask her,
were you nervous?
Oh yeah. I mean, and still to this day, I mean, those Led Zeppelin records are just, they're like architectural masterpieces that you have to kind of continually go back to in my mind.
Right.
Yeah, no question.
As a member of a band and as someone who loves making records and just someone who plays guitar. So yeah, I think that probably stands out.
So we're gonna end this podcast with the tune that you sent me. Ain't No Secret is the name of the tune.
No Secret, baby. Yeah.
Tell us about that tune before we roll into it.
It's really just kind of, so the album Wolves, the first solo record, is really kind of a dark divorce album, you know.
That was a very brave record. I was checking that out today.
Thanks, man.
It's kind of like a modern Blood on the Tracks or something.
Oh, I appreciate that, brother. Yeah.
I mean, it's really cool. And man, your vocals on the song Ghost Towns.
Yeah.
The video that you got out. I think you've got a really great voice that also, there's something about your voice that it feels very real.
Thank you.
I mean, you can, the lyrics feel like you meant it, and
thank you,
I got that just from first listen. I was kind of amazed in the economy of your guitar playing on that.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, just the hooks, and it was like, I'm going, okay, he's going to let rip something here. And yeah, you never did, man. And right, I applaud you for that.
Thank you, man. Yeah.
Very nice. Great, yeah, great arranging and songwriting.
I try to be careful not to enter into the shred zone too often. You know what I mean? But let me just point out real quick. So Wolves was, you know, I went through a very contentious, kind of ugly, dark divorce, and it drug on for a minute, and it ended very poorly. And Wolves was an album that was more of a sort of a therapeutic statement, really. And it was kind of a risky artistic thing to put out there, because it wasn't like, hey, everybody get up, let's kind of record. It was like, you know, look at my sad state of affairs, and let me just dive into my own kind of sorrow.
It was your face value album, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and so I just decided, yeah, I'm going to put this out. And so this next record is a lot more, you know, upbeat, and a lot more less personal. But that particular title, Ain't No Secret, is there's a lot more of acceptance of the reasons that rather than being angry about what led to the divorce, you know, there's a lot more of acceptance on the second record, In Your Own Time. And Ain't No Secret is just, it's a little bit of a wink, wink that, you know, it's no secret that you're not my drug anymore. It's no secret that you're not my love anymore. That we've sort of accepted the reasons that things ended the way they did. And, you know, we have two daughters together. So there's that feeling that even when things are ugly, you have to figure out a way to maintain some kind of relationship, or at least accept why things are the way they are for your kids.
Been there, done that.
I think that's what that song's saying.
Yeah.
And they're done that too.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's a great song. Well, thank you, Kyle, for joining us today. We certainly appreciate it.
Lovely finally meeting you, Dane. Lovely meeting you, Hugh.
You too.
Great to meet you, Kyle.
You guys be safe. Take care of yourselves, all right?
Yeah. Thanks for joining us on the Music Buzz podcast.
Thanks for chatting with us,
Kyle. Take care.
Thank you. See you, Kyle. Thank you. We're going to roll into Ain't No Secret by Kyle Cook. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you next time on the Music Buzz podcast.
training is right around the corner. So come for the games and have a ball in Arizona. With world-class resorts, unbeatable dining and nightlife, amazing scenery, and endless outdoor adventure. Make your visit unforgettable. Plan your getaway at myspringtraining.com.